CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com. All right. If you've got issues on your podcast app and all the rest of it, you probably can't hear us at all. But for everybody else, we are continuing as normal. Apparently, there are technical people looking at it as we speak. Thank God there are experts in this respect because they're able to figure things out. And hopefully we'll be back up and running. Leanne and Sia and I are here with you this morning. Got a guest joining us a little bit later on. It's Monday. Moonday. So, as you were saying that you woke up this morning with a little bit of a scratchy throat and like the symptoms of a cold. That's not good.
So,
you know, whenever that happens, people are like, oh, God, I've got COVID.
Yeah, I'm not panicking. I'm just concerned because I was with my mom and dad yesterday.
Yeah.
And my mom's very compromised. So I'm a little bit concerned. And the symptoms started in the car on the way home where I just, you know, that when you get the burning in the ear, nose, and throat area.
Ooh.
Yeah. And you end up like swallowing a lot.
But doesn't that also
this morning
when you chug Sambuca and it goes down the wrong pipe?
Jeez. Talk about underage drinking. I haven't done that in a while. I've got quite a few symptoms now. So I think I'll go and get tested. It's always better to know, you know, like doctors will say, always get tested. It's the best thing to do because then at least you can inform people you've been with, you know, and do the responsible thing.
Well, go and get your test and let us know. We want to go through it with you if you do end up having the Rona.
The Rona.
I hope it's just a cold. I haven't had one of those in years, but perhaps it's one of those.
I thought I was getting a cold the other day and we're all primed to be like, you know, extremely sensitive to anything right now because you think, but I haven't, touch wood, been sick since like May last year. I felt really shitty for a couple of days. That's why I still think I had an early version of COVID then. But since then, luckily, I've managed to steer clear. I did start feeling a little bit meh on Thursday, but then by Friday it was gone. And I had such a nice weekend of just sleeping late and I didn't see another person from Friday sort of midday until Sunday lunchtime with the family. I didn't see any. I did zero on Friday night and Saturday night. It was so nice. I watched a whole bunch of movies, which was cool too. You know, it's so great living in 2020. You can connect your laptop up to your TV and you can watch things that way and sit there. And, you know, we've got like a microwave to make popcorn so that you can chill there with some popcorn, watch a movie. And just sitting on my own, I mean, it was me and the dog and it was so fucking great. Like, I just loved it. You know, I feel very sorry for people who are in relationships because they can't always just do that. And they argue about which movie. And here I am, like, enjoying it all. Felt very spoiled.
Yeah, that is really the best part about being single. Like, you don't have to have meal times. When you're hungry, you'll eat.
Yeah, and
it's not a big deal.
For yourself.
I don't have to check with someone else. And if I like the one movie and I want to watch the next one, I just roll straight into the next one. I don't know. Hey, are you tired? Do you want to go to sleep? You know, what's it like? It was so nice. And I walked around my house all on my own, just like moving shit around and tidying up yesterday, and it was so great. Don't have to explain it.
I can't imagine the number of people we're pissing off right now.
I know.
Someone who spent the weekend with all three of their kids and the husband. You go, damn you.
Steph says, how was the English breakfast? Because I was threatening last week. I had such a hankering for a, you know, good English breakfast, and I didn't get to it, I'm afraid, Steph. So I'll have to do it this week sometime. But I did feel like I needed to try and be healthy over the weekend. I felt very fat for most of last week and then going into the weekend. And I did kind of eat unhealthy food last week. So I thought, you know, an English fry up probably wasn't the best idea. Very oily. Maybe I'll get to it this coming weekend. We'll see. But I'm making excuses. I just basically forgot. All right. Apparently, Oscar Pistorius, this is an interesting story. Apparently, Oscar Pistorius is going to be eligible for parole in May 2023, which sounds about right. I mean, he was sentenced to how many years? Does anyone even remember?
13 years. Yeah, the murder sentence was 6 years behind bars. But
so then he should be up for parole. Now, does anyone have a problem with that? Because
yes, the Steenkamps do. They're fuming. Oh,
okay.
I tried to read and understand the story, but I don't always understand at matters of parole and time that you've already spent, and there's an issue of 500 days that he'd already spent in jail. So where do they start counting from?
Right.
It's a pure math thing that I don't care to get into, but I do know that the Steenkamps are furious.
Well, they're the only ones whose opinion really matters. The rest of us don't. I'll just say that I think, you know, we've discussed this before, like spending a month in a South African prison would be hell. After a month, does it really matter how long you're in for? I don't know. It must be the most terrible place to be. And of course, you know, he murdered Reva and the court found that he'd murdered her and that's why he's in jail. And I'm not going to change any of that. And neither do I feel particularly sympathetic to the guy. But when you've done your time, you've done your time. We have to learn that there are certain paths to redemption. And if serving time in prison isn't a path to redemption, then why bother with prisons?
I wonder what his life is going to be like after prison.
Oh, you know.
Should he leave prison in the next couple of years? What will he do?
We were all so into the story. Remember how big a deal it was around, what was it, 2014, 15?
Well, the shooting happened in 2013.
Yeah, so I think the trial started. We were all into 24/7. Yeah.
For me, I sometimes, like you say, what will life be for him? And I really hope that one day we get to hear his story, the truth.
Right. Yeah, he's got to tell us the truth then.
But that would feel like, and I mean, we in no way deserve the story. You know, it's the Steenkamps who do.
Yeah.
But we also, because we were such fans and so involved in the story, it would it would feel really nice to know the truth, to hear the truth from him.
I don't know that that's a priority of his anymore, and I think that ship has sailed. You know, everybody wants to. We are all curious about what really went down, and he's the only living person who was there, who knows the true story. And we've figured out, because human memory is not as good as people think it is. Apparently, you know, our memories have this funny way of weaving their own version of reality. So by now, who's even to say that his version would be accurate? It would be more accurate than anyone else who's trying to piece it together, maybe. But in his own head, he may have come up with his own narrative for what happened. And he might have spent the last 6 years trying to convince himself that that's true. I don't think it matters anymore. I think that ship has sailed. I think it's done. Now it's really about, like, what do you do from here? You know? And if the guy has served his time and by 2023, which is still, you know, it's still 2 years away, and being in prison, like I've said before, it's just the worst possible thing that could happen. I would rather die than go to prison in South Africa.
Mm. Redemption is the key here. And this is putting us as society to the test to see just how much we can walk the walk, you know, once we talk this talk of, yeah, well, serve your time and that'll be it. But what will you think when you see us get your local grocery store? You know, are we at a point as a society to go, yeah, this is fine, this is cool?
What do you think? I mean, how would you feel if you see him at your local grocery store?
I wouldn't even want to be close to him. I'd hightail it out of there. But I don't see him even being in South Africa. I think he'll have to go elsewhere. The last I heard, because, you know, I had tried as well to get Emma for the show a few years ago. Yeah, from people close to her, she had left the country as well.
Oh, wow. That would make sense.
Yeah, she doesn't. I really don't think they can live here.
I just wonder, because if we want to live in a society where we get better and not worse, and where we figure out ways of dealing with bad people, and I mean, you know, everyone's a bad and a good person, but obviously some of us act on it. And I'm not going to make excuses for him, like I said earlier, because the court's already found him guilty. There's no more to be said from my point of view that's going to illuminate any of us on this situation. But it is worth noting that if Oscar is to be forgiven eventually for big evil things, that makes it possible for you and I to be forgiven of smaller evil things in our own lives. And if you want the one but not the other, you're a hypocrite. There needs to be, like, the story of humanity is the story of kind of being imperfect and being forgiven. We've got to find ways for people to be redeemed. Now, if going to prison is part of your route to redemption, then we should allow parole to happen eventually. I mean, you know, we do this for, you know, political prisoners, for example, because we find that a political prisoner is not as egregious a problem to society as a murderer or a rapist. And obviously that's true for a number of reasons. Another thing that people find completely unacceptable is child abusers. Very often they get murdered in prison because even prisoners find them morally reprehensible. But there's got to be some way for us to forgive each other at a certain level. Now, I'm not saying murderers and rapists need to be forgiven. Don't jump to conclusions. But, like, what's the arc? What's the story here? Like, how do you reform as a person if there is no way for you to be forgiven? Why would you bother to reform? You just stay a murderer and you keep murdering. Mm. And when you get out of prison, you say, okay, time for some more murdering.
I mean, we have to remember that part of the reason why we feel satisfaction and, like, justification when someone is sent to prison is because we know, A, they're going to have a horrible time. B, they're being taken. Everything about their lives has been taken away from them. It's a real true punishment. But also that they've had so much time to sit with this. They may have reformed. They may have realized what they did. They may have got the story straight in their head, and they may have been influenced to the point where they realize what they did.
Yeah. Mm. Look, I just want to quickly interrupt this conversation. We can carry it on in a second. Just to welcome everybody on the app who have been missing out on the first hour of the show this morning. I'm really sorry. We had some technical issues in the studio, which they've just resolved. So well done, Simpiwe and the team in studio for fixing that. Because we've been here since 6, I promise. We weren't skiving off this morning. but we've obviously had a bit of a connection problem with the studio. Sia and Leanne and I have been carrying on here on Webinar Jam. But for those of you who were listening on the app and didn't hear anything, I'm terribly sorry. We've figured it out, and I promise it won't happen again. You see, please forgive me. We were just talking about forgiveness because apparently Oscar Pistorius is eligible for parole in March of 2023. So if you came into that conversation and you were confused, that's what we were talking about. But John says, and this is an interesting thing to discuss if you want to get philosophical this morning. Murder has no forgiveness. We should have life or the death penalty if we could trust justice. So a fairly unforgiving line from John. You know, John, murder in self-defense is just a human way of, I'm not referring here to the Oscar trial at all, but let's say someone broke into your house, John, and you shot them. That's still murder, even though legally, by human convention, by an artificial set of rules which humans have made up, you can use self-defense as a defense for having killed someone. But in terms of life and death and universal morality, you've killed a person, right? Even if they had negative intentions towards you, you've killed a person. So does that mean that by your rationale, that's also unforgivable? See, it's very... It gets very complicated.
I have to put myself in similar situations mentally. And I've been in situations where I could have become a killer. I've been in situations where I've been so angry in the situation. I may have thrown something across the room. Who's to say if I had access to a gun that I might not have used it? That snap anger.
Sure.
I just feel like if that had have happened to me and I had have killed someone and I had many years to realize what I'd done and live with the pain, then I would sincerely hope that society might consider forgiving me.
And look, murder is a big thing that would define a person or the type of you are. But that's not all of you. So now that you've killed, we should just write you off, like using that's something John, like what John is saying. Yeah.
No, John's saying that once you've committed murder, you're a lost cause and you should just be left to die in prison or you should be put to death.
It's a horrible thing.
I know. I mean, it's a very cold and unforgiving world that John lives in. I'm glad that he's not our president. I don't mean any disrespect. You might be a very nice person, John, but that is a philosophy that can only go in one direction. And again, if you don't build the mechanism for forgiveness in, then how do we improve? How do we move forward as a species? You know, how does the human story become better and not worse? If we just imagine that by killing off the killers, and remember, someone has to put those people to death. Are they also murderers? By doing that, you're not going to clean up society. That's a very like Torquemada and the Inquisition kind of point of view. It's a very scary thing to have that perspective. And maybe, you know, maybe you can explain it. Maybe it's much more nuanced than what you've written there. But I think the world where that philosophy exists is a very cold, unforgiving world. And there are many people throughout history who have been forgiven of crimes like murder and have gone on to do good things for humanity. And that's not always the case. Many murderers just become recidivists and go straight back to murdering, as I mentioned earlier. But I think if you can create space in someone's head for them to feel that they might be forgiven one day for the things that they've done, whether those are hugely dangerous and shit things like murder, or whether they're much more, you know, kind of commonplace and the kinds of things that we should all be forgiving each other for. If you don't create a space for forgiveness, we don't improve. And why would people become better? Why not just become more animalistic and more vicious and more brutal? This is Hobbesian. If you're interested in this, this is kind of political philosophy of the 1700s. It's really good stuff.
But also, you know, I think it's easy for us to comment because we aren't directly in it. I don't know if I was the Steenkamp if I would have the same philosophy.
Well, luckily it's none of our problem. The three of us and everybody who's listening, we don't have a say and we don't have to sit in that parole hearing. Thank goodness. We can just spectate and we can have opinions on a podcast like we are. All right. So I don't want to get down that rabbit hole too much because it just leads to massive arguments, which are sometimes not very productive. And as I said at the beginning of this, legal philosophers have been debating this stuff since the dawn of humankind and sentience and consciousness. I don't think we're going to solve it this morning. But here's something interesting, and I want your comments on this. This is from Fern. Fern says, my brother bought me a 10 by 10 meter piece of ground in Scotland. It's part of a reforestation venture called Highland Titles. Now, along with the paperwork, you receive a card that identifies you as Lady Fern. Mm-hmm. Apparently, if you own land in Scotland, you automatically become a lord or lady. It was this title that drew my brother to the scheme in the first place. He has delusions of grandeur. I think it's really funny. Unfortunately, I've not had occasion to use the card, but it'll come. I look forward to seeing the reaction. Sia, I think you need to buy a tiny patch of land in Scotland. Regards, Fern.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So do you want me to handle this seriously or stupidly? Because I can take it in any direction. I'll give you the facts and then you can tell me what you think of it.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I think it's a good initiative.
Yeah.
And it's quite funny and it could be a nice gift.
Yeah, I think this is entertaining. It's a great way for us to plant more trees and to look after the environment a little bit better and to do things that we can make, you know, parts of the world, even if it is far away, feel a bit better. And it is true that in Scotland, you can be called Laird, L-A-I-R-D, of a piece of property if you own it. but a 10x10 piece of property that anyone can buy. This is not a title that the Queen has conferred on you, by the way. So it's not like a proper barony or viscountcy or earldom or marquisate or dukedom, which are the actual titles that the Crown dispenses and has over time. I don't think the Queen has created any new life peerages. I mean, not life peerages, hereditary peerages, since like the 60s. She's certainly created life peerages. In other words, that you are lord or lady, whatever, you're given a title, but it dies with you. In other words, you can't have it inherited by your children. I don't know that she's created any new life peerages since about the 50s. I think those are finished. In other words, there will be no more dukes or earls or marquises or viscounts. There might be barons, but they're probably going to be life barons, which means that the title expires with you at your death. And therefore, I don't see any difference between this, which is essentially owning a piece of property, which was the old bare minimum for being called landed gentry. You know, for being called a gentleman in the old days, you had to own property and be armigerous, which means you had to own a coat of arms.
These are a lot of words I need to Google.
Yeah. So if you had a coat of arms and you owned property, you were a gentleman.
So you weren't the guy working the pigsty on the farm.
No, that was
and, then you and were sleeping with the horses.
Then you were a peasant. That was peasant. But yeah, so Fern, I suppose you could go with this, but it doesn't. It's not a real title. Like, there's a book I've got here, and it's downstairs. It's called Burke's Peerage, and it's actually three volumes that each book is this thick, and it lists the families and the people all over England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, who are aristocrats, in other words, who have titles, proper titles. And they won't list people who own, you know, a 10x10 meter square piece of property in Scotland in that book. So you can't go and put it on your letterhead and, you know, and write on your plane tickets, Lord C.S. Sanguini. It'll be a funny thing to have, and if it's planting some trees and it's looking after some land in Scotland, good. You've contributed to, you've offset your carbon emissions. Who could argue with that? So go ahead and do it. And Fern, I'm proud of you. Well done. Your brother's done good things, even if he does have delusions of grandeur. Sia would love this. In fact, Sia, that's going to be your birthday present for me next year, or even for Christmas this year, depending.
I'm for this.
Tracy says, blind history, when is it back? I can't wait. Actually, we have a meeting coming up this week to discuss the rollout of the next season of Blind History. Remember last year, I think we only started the new season in March, but we're looking to get cracking on that ASAP. So you may even have an episode before the end of February. We'll see. We're going to try and do that for you. But Anthony and Kate and the team at Taylor are very excited about it. So I am too. Roycott says, droit du seigneur is the only reason to become a Lord of Scotland. Do you know what that is? Droit du seigneur.
No idea. Something the triple senior?
No, it means that you have the right to have sex with anyone who lives on your land. It's an old medieval.
Oh, my God.
I don't know whether it was ever enforced, but yeah, it used to be a thing. It was certainly a... It was a term people used to use, but if you had droit de seigneur, droit is a right, and de seigneur is the owner of the land, obviously the land, the gentry, the people who own the property. And you could go around and you could have sex in, I mean, we're talking like 900 AD, so this is a very long time. You'd walk around, you'd be like, you look nice. Bend over and pull up your, I don't know, your petticoats. It wouldn't even have been petticoats. It would have been dirty old rags.
Furs and rags. You
know, red power in the wrong hands.
Oh, it's horrible. It's
a dangerous thing. There were men who decided, yeah, that this is a great thing that we need.
Sure.
And they went with it.
A lot of people say that Sia would be an excellent lord or even a sir. Sir Sia Sanguini.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ruth says, fornication under command of the king is where the word fuck comes from. It might not be true. In fact, I've read some versions of Yeah, the etymology of the word fuck and where exactly it originates from, and it's not 100% clear cut. So that may be the case, Ruth. I'm not going to disagree with you, but it might not be. All right. We got lots of other things that we've got to get to, but Fern's email I thought was important. We're going to be joined in a little while by somebody who I'm very keen to speak to, McLean Sibanda, who's an author and entrepreneur. And we've got to talk about what it'll take to wake up South Africa's economy, right? Because we've been through a really, really... Whoa, Leanne. Oh, that's definitely the vid.
Sorry, didn't get to the button in time.
Now you've seen it. Now you've sneezed all over all of us, and you didn't have a mask on. What are we going to do?
I felt that.
I felt so rebellious.
So as I was saying, we need to start up the economy again, virtually from scratch, and entrepreneurship is going to be a big part of that. And I thought we would talk to McLean Sibanda this morning. He's written a book called Nuts and Bolts, Strengthening Africa's Innovation and Entrepreneurship Ecosystems. And it highlights great lessons that we need to remember in times like these. So we'll be speaking to McLean just now about the book and about entrepreneurship and what we can do in South Africa to get things going. I went to the shops on Saturday morning. I needed to go and get some things for the house. And it was busy. You know, there were a lot of people. One of the shops that I went to, there were queues. So evidently it's not all dead and buried. And there are people who are doing things. I certainly get the feeling like everybody wants stuff to happen now.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I ventured out on Saturday morning to collect some wine because I'd forgotten about the no weekends rule. And everyone was bustling about doing stuff. Everyone was busy and standing in queues, ready to go into restaurants and, you know, going around with trailers and home improving and visiting family and golfing. And it was quite nice to see, actually.
Well, I just like seeing activity. And apparently the restaurants are up and running again. And in many places, they roaring trade, which is terrific. We've all got to get out there and support the restaurants however we can. And I know nobody's really sitting on piles of money right now. But I think any feeling of normality is to be encouraged, and any normal economic activity is to be encouraged, because we've all got a little bit of cabin fever, but we've also got a bit of kind of home Stockholm syndrome, if that makes any sense. Like, a lot of people are afraid to get out because they're so used to being in that when they go out, they're a little apprehensive.
Agoraphobia.
Yeah, I'm telling you, there's a thing happening there. So it's worth discussing, and maybe that's something that McLean wants to talk about as well this morning. So, hey, Mr. Sibanda, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Gareth. How are you?
Good morning. Nice to see you. We have met before a couple of times. I recognize the face, and it's nice to see you, and good luck with your new book, which is called Nuts and Bolts, Strengthening Africa's Innovation and Entrepreneurship Ecosystems. So let's just talk, let's get straight into it, because I'm sure that, you know, we can sit here and share lockdown stories, but you and I both know that there are so many people who are suffering at the moment. There's so many people who are unemployed. We had this problem going into the pandemic. So I'm hoping that you have some answers in your book, and I'm hoping that you will help us this morning and inspire us a little bit as what we can do to fix the situation we're in. There's no point in sitting and moaning about it. We've got to fix things. Where do you think we can even start?
So thank you very much for hosting me. So I think one of the things that has become very clear over the years is that small businesses are the future. And I think we've seen that not only, you know, in Africa, we've seen it in the Asian countries. Even if one looks at a company like Samsung, it didn't start as a large company. It was, in essence, a family-owned business. That then, was strengthened by acquiring intellectual property that was developed elsewhere and developing its own intellectual property. So I think bringing it home, where we are, you know, at the moment is really to, support innovative, startups. So I think there's a difference between just an SME and a startup. And I think we need to be looking at those small, you know, businesses, startups that have got an innovative idea that can scale, that can create, you know, jobs. And here I borrow from Harvard Professor Christensen, who says that innovation is taking labor, capital, information, and material, and in essence transforming it into goods and services of a greater value. And so with Africa's challenges and currently high unemployment, poverty, inequality, the question is, what can we actually do to solve those problems? There's enough problems, and enough problems means that there's huge potential for innovation.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think that innovation is going to be the thing that drives forward the kind of entrepreneurship that we're looking for in 2021. But obviously there are also limitations. I just want to focus on the positive for a moment. Technology has made it possible for people to start businesses with very limited resources and make a living and eventually build a business based on, you know, the ability for people to communicate like never before. Are you optimistic, especially because we live in a time where there is such an enormous opportunity presented by devices and the internet and the marketing potentials and possibilities of things like social media? I mean, this has obviously revolutionized things. Before, you needed some capital to start a business, and you needed to have a physical place. You needed to have a market. You needed to reach them somehow. All of that's been made a lot easier, right, McLean?
Yes, yeah, no, it has. And I believe that Africa is well placed to really take advantage of these opportunities. We are a youthful continent, even if one takes South Africa as a case in point, you know, close to 50-60%, you know, the population is considered youthful. And this is a population that embraces technology. And I remember going into Nairobi in 2011-2012. And at that particular time, Nokia was, really, the big, brand of cell phones. And it was also the boom of the mobile apps, industry. And seeing how young people were developing apps that then can be used, on phones. And so there's a huge opportunity to really take advantage of the devices, the technology. And also, coding is an easier, sector to get into. I think, we've seen great young people that don't even have a matric or university education actually learn how to code and start to develop, solutions in that regard.
Yeah, this coding thing is obviously, that's going to be a massive space for opportunities and employment in the future. But there are also lots of people who on the ground can solve problems. And I'm glad you brought up solving problems, because we have lots of them in Africa. And we have, as you mentioned, a young population who are hungry to get ahead and sort themselves out and create opportunities. And all of those are good factors. They're factors which won't create the complacency that we see in so many other countries in the developed world. But these problems sometimes are simple to solve and are much more local. And sometimes they're enormous and international. And I suppose there are rewards built in, depending on how difficult the problem is that you solve, the more money you can make. And that's really the driving force here. But do you think that we are being hampered and that our progress and our ability to innovate is slowed down by regulation, by government, by red tape, by the kind of old school thinking that so many people still embrace and espouse?
Yeah, so before I get to the regulation, I think it's actually great that you mentioned the way that we solve problems, because I think one of the things people tend to think of innovation as requiring a lot of R&D and a lot of technology. But in essence, it's inclusive innovation where people can innovate within their own communities. And in the book, Nuts and Bolts, are going to the work of the Innovation Hub in Ekasi Labs, where we went into the communities and in essence, we're encouraging communities to identify problems in their own vicinity and start to solve them. So the incentive is actually there. The first incentive is actually solving a problem and contributing to betterment of humanity. And then obviously the financial rewards were to come in, and I always warn that if you actually go into entrepreneurship and innovation with the financial reward as being top in mind, you are likely to actually fail because your why is not big enough. Now, what we've seen, however, is some of the innovations that have been funded or supported by government don't make it into the marketplace or don't scale. You take, for example, Memeza, which is a community alarm system that Tulim Tetu had developed. It's found it very difficult to be fully embraced, although the SAP is on board and so forth. The challenge has been, in essence, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, you know, and so forth. So government needs to actually then also start to look at enabling regulations and how to facilitate entry of these entrepreneurs into the mainstream, you know, industry.
So when you were writing this book, obviously you've written it during lockdown. What has the impact of that been on the ability for people to innovate and to, I think it's probably made many people think very carefully about the businesses that they were in, and it's created a whole new slew of opportunities, some of them not entirely legal. but I wonder, I mean, sometimes the smartest people are the ones who are willing to take the risks, right? Even if those risks might mean breaking regulations and laws. But obviously what you're talking about here is there's the spirit to an entrepreneur, which you don't get in everybody. And some people have it and some people don't. You can't teach entrepreneurship. It's more of a hunger and a desire than it is a skill. Would you agree?
Yes, I agree. I think you know, one of the things I talk about is that we have to create an environment where entrepreneurship becomes a culture.
Yeah.
And that environment is an environment where we become aware of problems and then we start to think around solutions. And, you know, so in a way, I think from a younger age, you can mold one towards entrepreneurship, you know, thinking so that they're able to actually identify problems, but immediately start to think about solutions as opposed to dwelling, on problems. And I think lockdown, in essence, and I think the pandemic has spurred, in essence, quite a few innovations. We've seen organizations like the CSIR starting to actually contribute. We're seeing people in different, settings starting to actually come up with innovations that assist in terms of keeping people safe. And I think it's a time that I think we can use competitions as well to start to really stimulate people to come out of the woodwork and bring forth their innovative ideas to solve not only this pandemic, because there'll be many pandemics in the future, and therefore we have to create the right kind of environments for us to be ready.
So, McLean, I don't want us to only give negative feedback to government, because you mentioned the Innovation Hub, which is something which they've really championed. And I don't know what the success rate there has been so far, but it's a great idea. And obviously, by making people think differently and by kind of engendering the culture of innovation in young people in South Africa, we will ultimately end up with more positive stories than negative. Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of the progress that you've already seen happening and the kinds of innovation that you're seeing take place in South Africa that you obviously did research for the book.
Yeah. So the book, Nuts and Bolts, captures, in essence, my journey and those of others during my tenure as the CEO there for about 7.5 years. I left in June, 2018.
Right.
And when I got in, the focus was on ICT. By the time I left, we had actually broadened our focus from ICT to green economy, bioeconomy, as well as inclusivity going into the townships. Now, in the book, I also include some of these stories where we've actually broadened the definition of innovation. There are stories about Portia M, cosmetics industry. There is Makamisa, which is in the, food industry. There is Pasega, Lesolang, water hygiene solutions that is looking at water security. There is an entrepreneur, it's quite a range of them. And also, I talk, about how do we then support these township-based, innovations. And there's, a couple of stories that I included there of success. I talk about a company called Altis Biologics, which started off as a born growth, you know, in a company, but now it is actually producing, contributing also to solutions to address some of the things that we're seeing, you know, from the pandemic.
I think that those are all such awesome examples, and you go into some detail in the book of obviously your experience there, and you've had plenty of it. Do you think that South Africa is naturally a place where innovation is prized, or do you think that the reason that we may be lagging a little bit is because we don't put enough emphasis on this kind of thing, and we talk, there's a lot of lip service that comes from corporate South Africa about entrepreneurship, but corporate South Africa is a very different machine to the kind of machine that entrepreneurs need to operate in. And obviously, and government and unions and all the other people who have hands on the levers of the economy, they all say that they're fans of entrepreneurship, but there aren't really any distinct advantages that are offered by any of those two entrepreneurs. In fact, very often they view them as being competitors, if not the enemy, in many spheres. So do you think we're in an environment that encourages that kind of thinking, or do you think we could do much to improve?
I think there's a lot more that we can do to improve. So in a study that the OECD had done on it was a territorial review of Gauteng, it had identified three challenges, and one of those challenges was the fact that the industry value chains were actually dominated by large and well-established firms, which made it quite difficult for new entrants to actually come in. And I think for large businesses, it's important for them to recognize that startups give them the innovative edge to move forward. One doesn't have to look very far. If we look at the vaccines, a key player in that was actually a biotech, you know, company. And these biotech companies tend to be small. They tend to be startups. They tend to be very innovative. And therefore, there's an opportunity for private sector, large industries, to really embrace innovation. On the other side, I think government should recognize the role of innovation. And again, I mean, we got back to the issue around regulations, create the right environment and regulations for these innovations to be absorbed into the marketplace. And I think if there's one thing, Gareth, that I would actually really take a serious relook at, mm-hmm. is how are we actually doing enterprise supply, development? And really, I think retweak it in such a way that its focus is on supporting innovation, long term, as opposed to compliance. I get a feeling that most companies do ESD from a compliance point of view. And right. there are lessons to be learned from China and the Asian tigers, which is long term. So we've got to be thinking long term, developing capabilities, and also manufacturing, because there's no benefit that one gets from just thinking about the idea without actually thinking how you translate it into goods and services.
Well, listen, good luck with the book. It sounds like something we all need. It's a bit of a shot in the arm to the South African economy. The book is called Nuts and Bolts, Strengthening Africa's Innovation and Entrepreneurship Ecosystems. It is by our guest, McLean Sibanda, and it's a pleasure to speak to you again, McLean. And I hope that the book is published far and wide and spread far and wide, and that everybody starts to get a bit of that spirit of entrepreneurship and innovation flowing in their brains and their veins.
Yeah, thank you very much, Gareth. Yeah, it's also available on Amazon. So the ebook can be found there.
Fantastic. Thank you for being with us this morning. Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. What happened to you, Leanne? Did your internet also get the COVID?
Yeah, it just went down. It went down all of a sudden. Excuse me.
Today has been a day of Leanne sneezing, technical difficulties across the board. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's not everything I hoped it would be, but these things happen.
Not all roses.
No.
And weekend gremlins.
And by the way, Pabalo brings up something that we did in December. Is Ozo still promoting people's businesses? Where can I get the details? That has ended, but we're talking to them again because there are lots of things that we want to do going forward this year. And Ozo introduced me to who was that guy who did the shoes? Do you remember we had him on one Wednesday morning when we were looking at the shoes? Batu Shoes. So I saw a huge big billboard in Midrand for Batu Shoes. It's enormous, enormous billboard, and it's like three sides of it because it's triangular, and then it's got this little bit at the other side, and they've got the shoes up there, and it looks amazing. And I'm just like, wow.
Awesome.
We heard about these guys in December, and I'm so pleased to see that they are advertising properly and they're getting out there, and people are obviously buying their shoes, which is a terrific story. And there were a lot of other businesses that we discovered during that that feature that we did with Ozo, which you can go and listen to, by the way. It's all on cliffcentral.com. And maybe we'll do it again.
Is their slogan, don't buy one shoe, buy two shoes?
I want to roll my eyes at that.
Actually, it's also clever.
That's so good. I love it.
Some people only need to buy one shoe.
Well, yeah, no, I'd love like, it.
No, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, no, we're not going to go back to topic we discussed earlier, right? That's what you were thinking.
Yes. It was just way too obvious.
So Jenny, who's been listening since 6 o'clock, says, when are you going to talk about Juju and the tea party? Yeah, I must be honest with you. I'm so cynical about these politicians here. You know, this is the guy, Julius Malema and Jacob Zuma. These two loved each other leading up to the Polokwane ANC elections. Remember when Thabo Mbeki was thrown out and Jacob Zuma was taken on as the president of the ANC. And part of the reason that he was elected at that conference was because the Youth League, under Julius Malema's leadership at the time, were very strongly behind Jacob Zuma. So they were best buddies, and they saw this bright future for themselves. Him, you know, Jacob as president, Julius as the heir apparent, and it was all going to be fantastic. And then, of course, things broke down pretty badly over the course of the Zuma presidency, to the point where Julius was kicked out of the ANC Youth League, something he's never got over, something the ANC Youth League has never got over. And let's not forget that in the last few months of Jacob Zuma's presidency, he couldn't even stand up and say anything in parliament without Julius Malema literally screaming and shouting at him. There was nothing but animosity and hatred between the two of them. Now suddenly they are best friends again, and they're getting together and having tea in Nkandla. And I see Tony Yengeni was there. I see Danny was there. It was quite a collection of some respectable and others less respectable people. I'm very cynical about these things. I'm sorry. I don't really buy any of it. I think it's all play acting. It's all propaganda. It's all for show. I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out that the EFF the whole time have just been a version of the ANC Youth League operating outside of the ANC. And that it's all been a big... You just don't know what to believe with these guys. Yeah. You know, they posture the whole time. They're just bullshitting you to try and confuse you. They foment social tensions. That's what the ANC and the EFF have done over the last couple of years. It's all they do. I mean, EFF in the form of, you know, constantly creating racial stress and tension. The ANC, in terms of, we know full well that the Zuma administration actually got Bell Pottinger involved, a professional spin company, to turn Africans on each other and distract us from Jacob Zuma and the Guptas. Didn't work, but doesn't mean that they didn't intend to do it. So these are not trustworthy people. I don't believe they have good intentions when they interact with each other or with us. And I don't for a minute think that when the doors close and the cameras are gone, that they don't sit there and laugh about how much they've got away with.
Completely.
You agree?
I agree with that. And Friday was just so clearly an example of the country being played. It's clearly a thing, you know? If they really just wanted to see each other, they could have seen each other and called it a day. To arrive with the helicopter, and then there was the media waiting outside, and then we see the photos, and yeah. they've been cooking something up, and I think they still will continue to cook something up. I will not be surprised if Zuma makes a great EFF endorsement or...
Oh, yeah, sure.
They'll just all, just to shake us up. This is exactly what it was. And it also might be, this is my burning platform one-liner analysis. It's also a move to our current president to say, hey, you know, look at us. We can still make things happen. It's a bit of like undermining the president
and,
as well.
And also our media are so stupid that they see the photo opportunity and the social story of like Julius and Jacob Zuma, who really have sold many newspapers and have been the fountains of many clicks on the internet. And they see these people as a way for them to have a story, an easy story. And the media don't ever ask the hard questions here, I'm afraid. They don't go, well, why are these two cynical shitheads who've been lying to us and basically bullshitting us for years? Why are the two of them getting together? Why is this a story? You know what I mean? What are they really doing? We can, if you just have the memory of a fruit bat, you'll be able to figure out that they've been playing us for a long time, that everything's a big act, that they are not trustworthy interlocutors, that these are not people who you can have sensible conversations with. And they don't care about you or me or the poor or any of that stuff. They're only interested in themselves. It makes me think of that. I saw a lot of people posting Wole Soyinka's quote about the leaders in Africa, and it fits so well with this narrative. I just want to read it to you because I want to include it in the TV show this week. Listen to this. So here it is. Nobel Prize winner Wole Soyinka said, "Only in Africa will thieves be regrouping to loot again, and the youth whose future is being stolen will be celebrating it."
Shitty but true.
I mean, it's just, you know, there are people who, I saw like a whole lot of people on social media over the weekend, like, oh, it's so great seeing Jacob Zuma and Julius Malema making friends. I'm like, you dummies. Do you really think that's what it's about? And yes, most people do think that's what it's about. That's why these politicians can get away with screwing all of us over time and time again.
I was surprised Duduzane wasn't there.
Yeah, don't worry. He's got lots of photo ops in the future, guaranteed. You just wait and see. Jesus. Again, yeah. I'm so cynical about these people. I really am. I just don't know what to say. These are not your friends. These are not people who mean you well. You know?
Definitely not.
If you left your wallet lying on a table and Julius Malema and Jacob Zuma are in the room, guaranteed one of the two of them would pick it up and leave with it and feel a goddamn thing. That's the kind of people we're dealing with.
And no, I feel like it would be bigger than that. By the time you got back to your car, it would have been, the tires would have been let down or something.
Because bigger than that, when is enough enough? Like, really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
this is all they know. It's all they've known since they were young boys.
They just literally,
they'll never stop.
They're regrouping around the truck. That's what they're doing. They're regrouping and finding, as the Inca says, new ways to steal from us. That's all. So don't fall for it, anybody. Please try to be awake and aware of this thing. All right. There's some other stuff we wanted to get to this morning. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but let me just quickly go to one or two of Leanne's points here. She wanted to talk about 8 signs that you're doing well in life. Do you think you can squeeze them into 5 minutes?
Yes.
Because this is
very
good.
Very much so.
I like, you know, leaving my notes. So in case you think you're doing badly, Leanne is about to disabuse you of that notion.
Let's take our papers out.
It's not very easy to feel very successful these days, you know. Absolutely. So we need a little bit of light coming our way.
Right.
So ask yourself. These are, you know, very healthy things to consider and measure your success by as a human being.
Okay.
You have a healthy relationship with money. So it doesn't mean that you're overflowing with money.
Sure.
Or that you're down in the doldrums, but you have a good relationship with money. Okay. Number 2, you're doing work that you find purposeful. And I think that there is something that, you know, a lot of people say, do what you love and do what you dream of. What do you love? But the thing is, does it have a purpose? I might love making flower art for my wall, but it actually doesn't have a purpose. So beyond loving it, you need to, you know that you're doing something to add to society. Number three, you have healthy, meaningful relationships. So again, not having a ton of friends, but just nurturing the friendships that you do and the family relationships that you do. Number four, you're taking care of your body and mind. And this is something that reminds me very much of what Gareth has said, with, you know, the fact that we should be looking after ourselves. It's the basis. It's putting on your own oxygen mask first. And looking after yourself before you have to look after others. Number five, you live with integrity. So what you mean and, you know, you say what you mean what you say, being honest with yourself. You're not afraid to be vulnerable. So it's about being vulnerable and being able to share stories with people about your difficulties or your triumphs. And just being honest and being upfront about what your weaknesses are.
Yeah.
Otherwise, so, it kind of eats away at you.
I like all of these so far. This makes a lot of sense.
Number seven, you're kind. I think that's super important. And that whole phrase has become a bit off after Ellen DeGeneres's "Be kind to one another."
Yeah, because she turned up. Well, yeah, I think that's massively important, and I sometimes think it's underestimated, like the quality in a person that they are kind is such a big deal, you know, especially in relationships. I remember one of my ex-girlfriends used to say there are two things that just immediately turned her off someone. One, if they were not generous, in other words, that they were selfish and didn't. You know, they were mean. They were mean about money. They were mean about their time. They were mean about their feelings. They didn't share. They weren't generous. And the other one was that they weren't kind. You know, not kind to animals, not kind to other people, not kind to old people, not kind to someone who's suffering. And being kind doesn't cost anything. It's a really simple thing to do. And it's such a powerful statement of someone's place in the world and the kind of things that they can do. It's just great.
Yeah, and For me, it's also understanding what other people might be going through. So you're driving behind a car that's going really slowly. Maybe they're transporting a person who's been injured and they don't want to go over the bumps too fast. You know, maybe they've got goods in the back that they don't want to break.
That's where Gareth kind of stops.
I struggle. No, I do. I struggle with this one, hey. I have a tough time on this. Because... I get annoyed straight away, and then
that was my input under the be kind category. So that was just my interpretation.
Okay.
And then number eight, you're down, but you don't plan to stay there. So if life hasn't been that kind to you lately, it's not a case of this is it, this is the end, I'm done. It's a case of I'm accepting that I'm down at the moment, but I know that I don't want this forever.
Yeah, you don't give up. Yeah. I like that. So those are some pretty good signs. And if you have a majority of those, then you're actually you're living well. You're doing well in life.
You can call yourself successful if you know those are the new markers of success. Having a lot of money or having lots of friends. Things have changed.
I think this is great. I love it. And that's amazing. Yeah, that's a positive note to end on. And I do think that, you know, there's so much that that Leanne's brought up there that's probably good life guidance, you know, life philosophy anyway. But we've discussed a bunch of things this morning. If you missed any of it, I'm really sorry. We had some technical issues in the first hour, and there may not be a podcast from 6 to 7, even though we did a show. There may, however, be everything that you want from 7 o'clock. So I'm holding thumbs. And we will see you tomorrow morning, 6 o'clock, bright and early. Have an excellent day, and we will catch you on the flip side. CliffCentral.com